This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take.
So we've been keeping a watch on shares of Beyond Meat because we've seen some selling pressure again today. In fact, at their lows, down as much as 9% or just shy of that, still down about 5% as we speak. And the stock, if I take a look at what it's doing, it is down 80%, Tim, so far in 2022.
We got Dina Shanker with us. She's consumer reporter for Bloomberg News. She covers Beyond Meat and other faux meat companies for Bloomberg News. We wanted to get her on the program because she had a deep dive that came out yesterday morning into dirty conditions at a key plant. It's a facility in Pennsylvania, and it illustrates the alt meat makers' ongoing difficulties. Dina Shanker joins us now via Zoom from New York City. Dina, according to these reports, what was found at that plant in Pennsylvania?
Hi, thank you guys so much for having me on. Basically, what we saw from photos and internal documents was a plant that was just not operating safely or following basic health and safety measures. We saw a lot of mold, both on ingredient containers and on the walls.
I mean, these pictures, Dina, are pretty shocking that are included in the piece.
Yeah, I mean, they are, because I don't think that any of us want to see a food plant that looks like this. You know, there are things in these pictures that many of us might not even notice as bad practice. But, for example, we have a picture that shows a trolley cart turned over into a large funnel type of shape of machine. And we can look at that and we can say that doesn't look right to me. We can't necessarily say why or exactly what's wrong with it. But the experts actually not only pointed out that, which they said is dangerous for the people involved. They said it's contaminated or there's room for contamination because you never want something with wheels on the floor to be that close to your food production surfaces. But if you look at that picture.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah, right. But if you look at that picture, you'll also see to the left, there's a bucket on a machine, and that was actually we don't even mention this in the story, but the experts also noticed that bucket. It's cut off in the photo, and they said, that bucket shouldn't be on a machine, and there's a hammer on a machine. They said, those things shouldn't be on those machines,
so they're supposed to be messy. And we got just for everybody who's watching on YouTube or Bloomberg Quick Take, you can actually see what Dina is talking about. Dina, I got to say mold, right? Like, I've dealt with it in my basement. Like, it starts to freak you out and you just take care of it because it can be dangerous. But mold growth takes a while, right? So it's not like, oops, we just missed it. It just happened. This stuff takes a while to develop.
That's right. And we see the mold on ingredient containers, but we also see it on the walls in one photo on a wall. And that's exactly right. It doesn't mean that this one day at this one moment in time somebody happened to capture a bad situation. It means that situation has been like that for a little while in order for that to happen.
Dina, where did these photos come from?
From a former employee who worked in the plant and was really concerned about the conditions in it.
And what did Beyond Meat tell you in response to inquiries related to these photos and what it showed at allegedly happening at the plant?
They said that the Pennsylvania Department of Agriculture found no instances of non-conformance with regulations during their inspection. They said that they go above and beyond industry and regulatory standards with their food safety protocol. They mentioned audits, which give them very high ratings. They did not comment specifically on the documents or the conditions we described to them from the photos.
One thing that emerged to me in terms of reading your piece was sort of this pattern of, I don't want to ascribe intent to this, but I was pretty surprised to see that basic paperwork and fees hadn't been paid to the state, like a $30 fee, I recall.
Yeah. Yeah. The $35 registration fee. That's right.
What does that illustrate to you?
That they're not following basic good practices, but, to me, I wonder who's in charge and where are they and, why is this such a pervasive problem in this plant? I mean, I have a lot more photos that we didn't include. So it goes way beyond, four photographs.
And you point out, for anybody who's listening at this point, internal reports also show that some contaminated products made it through to consumers. So ultimately, did a lot get out to consumers? What do we know? And I am curious, when it comes to Beyond Meat facilities, this Pennsylvania one, how important is it in terms of overall production?
So in terms of what reached consumers, what we know is that from the documents that were shared, that some wood in two separate A&W burgers at two different restaurants was found by consumers, and that a metal link was found in a bag of Dunkin' sausage patties. And there was recently a recall from Costco in Canada because of wood found in the products. That's what we have documents of from reporting this story. In terms of the role this plant plays in the company, it's actually a very important one because the company doesn't have a lot of its own real estate in the U.S. They have two sister sites in Columbia, Missouri, and this plant. And the plan had been for this plant to be upgraded and expanded. The company had been planning on doubling the size of this plant as recently as this summer. There were expectations that that would happen. So this was certainly an important, this is an important location for this company. Most of its manufacturing in the U.S. is done by co-manufacturers. They make their raw material, sort of like their secret sauce kind of ingredients at their Columbia facilities.
Dina Shanker, consumer reporter at Bloomberg News. Check out more. Just head to Bloomberg.com. Thank you, Dina. This is Bloomberg.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
I got to tell you, this conversations we are having behind the scenes right now when it comes to all things crypto, and I feel like crypto is this bucket where we throw everything in and not all crypto elements are the same, but it's just trying to stay on top of it and make sense of it.
We should have some of those conversations behind the scenes. We should have them on air.
So let's do that. Okay. Let's bring in Katie Greifeld, Bloomberg News Senior Markets Reporter, co-host of Crypto IRL on Bloomberg Quick Take and Bloomberg TV. She is here in studio, and we know one of the big stories today was the bankruptcy hearing getting underway for FTX.
First day motions. And what's unusual is that it took this long to have this hearing. Usually it happens much quicker. I mean, when did FTX file for bankruptcy? It feels like a literal year ago.
2 weeks ago.
2 weeks ago. So an unusual amount of time there. I mean, there was a lot to sort through. It seems like one of the key takeaways was the record keeping process, which we already knew. It was
You chuckling?
It was pretty lax. I mean, John J. Ray III, who's the new CEO at FTX, of course, was involved in the liquidation of Enron. He was pretty blunt that it was pretty much non-existent. But that was a consistent theme today, too, that there's really not a lot of records to go by. And when you're trying to sort out more than a million creditors, that's going to be a very long process. Huh. Someone knows who the top 50 creditors are. We don't know who they are because the names were redacted. And that's something that was discussed a lot today as well.
The FTX is set to be back in court, but not until January. So what happens between now and then, Katie?
Well, there is supposed to be a second hearing on the issue of the fact that the names were redacted on December 16th. Tim and I were talking about this yesterday with Stephen Church. Hopefully you weren't listening, Carol, because you were off. But
I wasn't.
It's really...
You were still working, though.
Really unusual that the names would be redacted. In this case, at least two groups of of the creditors sent lawyers to this hearing to support the request to keep their identity secret for now. One of those groups was representing members who were among the top 50 biggest. So the judge overruled objections from the U.S. trustee who is requesting that we, you know who these names are for now. So they're going to remain secret.
I mean, this to me then speaks to the contagion impact, right? Like, this is what we're trying to figure out, how far this goes, certainly within the crypto universe. It doesn't feel like it's hit certainly the rest of the asset class that is kind of our world on a general basis. But I mean, that's, what do we know about how much further this goes?
Well, that's one of the reasons why people want to know who are the top 50 creditors here. I mean, who had the most exposure? We know some of, you know, who might be on that list by their own admission. For example, Gemini, Galaxy, a few other names have come out and talked about their own exposure to FTX. But when you're trying to map where to look for the contagion, you would want to see this list.
What about the names that are out there that feel like, and we're going to talk to Kathy Wood about this. I mean, she's been buying Coinbase. She's been buying Grayscale. I think there are questions about, you know, are these untouched or not?
It's a great question. Coinbase is an interesting one because Coinbase, I mean, it's a U.S. publicly listed company. It falls under the purview of the SEC. From everything that we can see right now, it was untouched by this FTX blow up. But at the same time, I mean, the stock has just been obliterated, which is probably why Kathy is looking into it. She likes to buy the discounts. But if you think about the future of the crypto industry, it feels like there's been a lot of love lost for centralized exchanges such as Coinbase. You've seen a lot of movement into decentralized exchanges, back into decentralized finance, into these cold wallets. So if that's the future for crypto, this sort of like deglobalization of the industry, I don't know how Coinbase fits in there.
I
want to go back to the exposure question, Katie, because why are we hearing now that companies are struggling as a result of the contagion from FTX when a mere 2 weeks ago they were kind of talking about, oh, we'll be fine?
I think it had to work its way through the daisy chain. Like there was
Sorry to interrupt, but does that mean that they weren't directly connected to FTX, but a fall in digital asset prices has led them to have some sort of issue?
I mean, I'm sure that that's the case. Obviously, the lines have gone down as a result. Not as much as you might have expected if you're talking about the price of Bitcoin. But that is one of the forms that contagion can take. Maybe it's not a direct impact. Maybe you weren't a counterparty to FTX, but you're probably counterparty to someone who was a counterparty. And something that I've been thinking a lot about the crypto industry in the last few days is that so many functions are concentrated in these one companies. It's not unusual for a crypto company to be an exchange, a broker, a custodian. The list goes on. Those are all separate functions in TradFi.
So go to Digital Currency Group, Barry Silbert's like, you know, so they write Grayscale Bitcoin Trust is, I think they're the largest shareholder in that. Or I think they own about 10% of Grayscale. And then you think about, they also own the crypto broker Genesis, which was affiliated with Alameda. And I guess, like, what do we know about Silbert and his world and the tentacles and where they go?
I would love to know more about
and I'm
it.
Not, but I'm not pointing my fingers at anything's wrong, but I just feel like it's, once again, that equation akin to what we saw with FTX.
Well, we know that Genesis, which again falls under his empire, is searching for fresh funding right now. Bloomberg News had a fantastic scoop yesterday that they need fresh funding or bankruptcy is in the offing. Barry Silbert also owns Grayscale. Like you said, they're the DCG, Digital Currency Group, is the largest shareholder in the Bitcoin Trust. So even though Grayscale, from all that we know, is fine here, their largest shareholder might come under some pressure if Genesis, which is also in the empire, files for bankruptcy.
Okay, so what could be the next shoes to drop in 30 seconds?
I would watch Genesis. That's what everyone's looking for now. I mean, it's hard to overstate Barry Silbert's reach.
Yeah. It is interesting, these singular individuals, right, who we look to kind of as a North Star. And again, I'm not saying anybody, I mean, at least Barry Silbert, we don't know anything that has gone wrong, but it's just interesting, these singular individuals and how wide and vast their reach was in different verticals within the crypto world.
Exactly.
So, okay. Katie, thank you. Sorry. It's just, you know, that kind of
I've been called worse.
Katie Greifel, Bloomberg News Senior Markets Reporter, co-host of Crypto IRL and our go-to when it comes to the crypto universe, joining us in studio. This is Bloomberg.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus & Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
There's a lot in the spotlight today. Crypto, of course, Twitter and Elon, that's a given. And then there is always, I feel like in the background as of late, the private equity world, which is no doubt about it, in the sights of Washington and an array of regulators.
Leah Nylon writes all about it. She's an antitrust reporter for Bloomberg News. She joins us right now from our 99.1 studio in Washington. Check out her story. It's on the Bloomberg Terminal and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Joel Weber is the editor of Bloomberg Businessweek. He's with us right now in the Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. Joel, Leah wrote this story with Todd Shields as well. And I got to tell you, I thought, you know, with carried interest being safe after almost dying a few months ago, thanks to a couple senators on the Democratic side, what else is in the crosshairs of lawmakers?
Oh, maybe everything about it.
everything about private equity.
Yeah, exactly. So that's right. I think carried interest has been the thing that people have long associated with the private equity industry. And it has come up many a times, and it kind of gets kicked around and then kicked down. And what's interesting now is about the Biden administration and regulators throughout agencies that are starting to kind of like pinch these places that private equity doesn't like to get pinched. And that has, it's not like a direct thing. Biden isn't quoted saying that he's coming for the industry. But it's sort. But if you read between the lines, there's clearly something happening here. So Leah, tell us more.
Yeah. So there are quite a few regulators here in Washington who've sort of set their sights on private equity. The SEC has proposed new rules about disclosure, and the antitrust regulators, that's the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission, have both made some noise about how they have concerns here. The Justice Department opened a surprise probe a month or so ago into what are called interlocking directorates. That's where a company or a person sits on the board of two competitors. And after they announced this probe, Thoma Bravo directors stepped down from two different public companies. They've also sent out notes to a couple other major private equity folks like Apollo and Blackstone, raising some concerns about some of their holdings. And then the sort of centerpiece of our story was about this deal between Standard General, which is a hedge fund, and Tegna, which is the broadcast stations that were spun out of Gannett. But the sort of interesting piece about this deal is that it's backed by Apollo. And so that aspect has sort of put it under the microscope with both telecom regulators and the Justice Department, who need to clear the deal before it can go through.
So, Leah, talk a little bit about the idea of transparency here, because this is an industry that, you know, inherently is private, right?
Well, I was going to say they don't call it private equity for
Exactly. So I'm wondering what you're hearing from the industry, because you quote some folks who represent the industry about what they think about this. And look, there's politics here, too. And you think of prominent donors as well.
Yeah, they're not that happy about this. I'll put it that
way.
You know, they think that they're doing good. They're investing in lots of companies. None of these, as Joel said, none of these are sort of direct attacks. You're not hearing Joe Biden say anything about private equity, but these are sort of his people within the administration giving them a little bit of a poke at some of the things that they've done for a long period of time. I mean, sitting on the boards of various companies is something that has gone on for quite a while. But the Justice Department noted, you know, this law has existed since 1914. Just because you guys have done it for the past couple decades doesn't necessarily mean it's legal.
Leah, what's the truth about private equity? Or is it a little bit of everything? Meaning that they sometimes come in, provide the funding when others don't want to touch something. Sometimes it's distressed assets or what have you. The other flip side is, you know, a lot of cost cutting, a quick way of like within a 2 or 3 year
little
horizon.
Bit of debt added to the companies, a little bit of debt,
job, you know,
job creation.
And spin it out and make some money. So what's the truth when it comes to private equity?
I mean, that's a little bit of a complicated question. I'll just say that the ones that the regulators are concerned about, they say, you know, there's not one size fits all here. There are some good things that private equity can do, but the ones that really raise their concerns are sort of what we might call a strip and flip, you know, where you come in, you load it down with debt, and then you sell it off, and it's not going to do as well. The other ones that they're really concerned with are roll-ups, right? So you might buy one company, and then you start adding on more and more and more companies, and some of these are small, so it might not have come to the attention of regulators that they're sort of amassing this dominant player in a market.
Okay, so what are some of the latest volleys? Because and talk through the agencies that are kind of nipping here. Which ones are you guys watching in D.C.?
Yeah, so I primarily focus a lot on the Justice Department and the Federal Trade Commission. The Justice Department is the one that's doing this probe into interlocking directorates, as they're called, and also it's looking at the Standard General Tegna merger. The FTC is a consumer protection and antitrust regulator. It has raised a little bit of concerns about private equity in the healthcare space. You know, there have been some articles in the press about how maybe when private equity invests in healthcare, that the health outcomes aren't as good. This is looking particularly at things like nursing homes. The FTC actually had a settlement earlier this year with JAB over it rolling up a bunch of emergency veterinary clinics. They were concerned that they had sort of bought three different emergency vet clinics, rolled them up into one, and maybe that was increasing prices when, you know, your dog accidentally swallows your shoe or something. So, you know, these are,
like
are the
sock,
sort of things.
But yeah.
You're speaking from experience, Joel. Hey, Leah, before we let you go, I'm curious how this is rippling into fundraising, and it's probably difficult to make a connection at this point because this stuff kind of takes years to work through a system. But when you talk to your sources about going out and raising money from LPs, what are GPs telling you about whether or not it's more difficult because of potential regulatory scrutiny?
I mean, that's definitely something that you have to pay attention to now. You know, this is the sort of thing that has to be thought about when you're doing a deal, whether the review might be extended. In the Standard General Tegna case, they had hoped that this deal would get review within 9 months, and they had added this provision called ticking fees. So the longer the review takes, the more money they're actually going to have to pay to Tegna shareholders. So they're not that happy about the fact that regulators are lengthening this deal, since it means that they're going to have to pay more.
I'm really curious, what's going to be the next turn of the screw that is going to make private equity, you know, call their local lobbyist?
Well, I mean, the Justice Department is continuing to investigate the interlocking directorates issue, and also, you know, just whether having private equity owners is changing the incentives of some companies. We're sort of expecting maybe a big private equity deal block maybe in the next year, where they'll sort of make this point either at the DOJ or the FTC.
All right. Certainly a relevant story and something that we've been talking about a lot here, I feel like, on Business Week on a regular basis. Leah, thank you so much. Leah Nyland, she is antitrust reporter at Bloomberg News in our 99.1 studio in Washington, D.C. Check out this story in the current issue of Bloomberg Business Week, and you can also find it on the Bloomberg and at Bloomberg.com/businessweek. Our thanks to Joel Weber, editor of Bloomberg Business Week, here in studio.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle-market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at stiefel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
I'm driving in my car. I turn on the radio.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I wanna drive.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. We're seeing some buying once again into the close. I feel like a broken record because I feel like over the last week or so, we've seen that a few times. We're now pretty much at our best levels of this day, Tim.
Interestingly enough, on the S&P 500 over the last 5 days, Carol, we're up only 0.2%.
Yeah, so right.
So, you know, it's been a little volatile.
Good perspective, yeah.
Let's get into it with Asha Mehta, founder and chief investment officer at Global Delta Capital. Also the author of Power of Capital, an adventure capitalist journey to a sustainable future, joining us via Zoom this afternoon. Asha, how are you?
Hi, I'm delighted to be with you.
It's good to have you with us this afternoon. I just want to start with the markets and then get a little bit into your book because this is some really interesting stuff. How would you describe where we are right now in terms of rate hikes, a tightening cycle, and when we're going to be on the other side of these?
This is a tough question to begin with, and I think we just heard in some of the former commentary about the rate cycle continuing, perhaps at a slower pace. What it speaks to is inflation that hasn't been experienced in a generation here in the developed markets. Thanks for the nice intro. I manage a strategy that focuses on emerging markets. So when I look at where we are with the markets more broadly at the moment, I'm seeing investors looking around for growth and thinking about how are we going to capture growth like we've seen over the last decade and the years to come, with inflation being where it is, with the rates rising as they are and continuing ahead. Investors who are looking for growth are starting to think beyond the single country, single sector concentrated approach that's been successful over the last decade. And again, I'm as an emerging markets investor, I'm starting to feel quite optimistic about the opportunity ahead for markets outside of the U.S.
Asha, you also think about, you know, emerging markets and or the intersection of emerging markets and fintech. And I just think about, you know, and you think about innovation, disruption, something we're going to talk a lot about with Cathy Wood in just about 10, 15 minutes time. But what's interesting, too, and I think with the backdrop of FTX and Sam Bankman-Fried, like, how are you thinking about that and the impact that they might have as kind of an investing class going forward?
I think it's one of the most critical themes. And thanks for introducing my book, Power of Capital. It's an adventure capitalist journey in which I introduce three mega themes that I see reshaping the globe. One of them is what we just talked about, the new global paradigm, the rise of the emerging markets and this new sort of growth class. Another one is around sustainable investing. But a critical theme is the one you just mentioned, technology. The reality is that the vast majority of the world's population today carries a supercomputer in their pockets. And in the emerging markets in particular, I see necessity as the mother of invention, an asset class that has had less access to liquidity today, has a very strong young demographic, which we all know is very quick to pick up technology. Some of the most exciting and scalable technologies across the globe are coming from Africa, where mobile money was born, China, where clean technology is hitting scale, and India, where some of the strongest technology universities in the world reside. So couldn't agree more. Technology is a critical mega theme, and there's lots of opportunity, not just in the sector, but in the context of vertical integration. It transforms every sector from finance to consumer to retail.
Well, help concentrate it a little bit or focus it a little bit for our audience. And I know you can't necessarily give picks, but can you get more specific with what you're bullish on and why?
Yeah. So I just alluded to some of it, and I'll spend a couple more moments on it. Mobile money, fintech, which you just brought up, I think is one of those critical themes that's reshaping the opportunity across developed markets. We're all experiencing the rise of mobile money, the ability to pay.
Are you separating this from crypto?
I do separate it from crypto, but I do look at digital currencies as another important innovation that, again, it has the opportunity to disrupt the opportunities ahead in terms of investing. You know, I think of digital money in terms of new sectors, the ability to invest in small caps that are, creating new forms of currency. But even in large cap financials, within emerging markets in particular, you know, but with digital money, they're able to access a much larger demographic. And again, that creates opportunity for revenue expansion across all aspects of the cap spectrum, and opportunity for earnings expansion, because the reality is technology, right, not particularly capital intensive.
Asha, I do want to just, did you have any exposure to the collapse of FTX in particular, or any of the fallout?
Thankfully, crypto is an area that I have limited exposure. I invested, like I said, in emerging market specifically, in equities within that.
Okay, good. Good to understand that. Okay, so can you talk about different regions? I mean, I know you mentioned India. I want to specifically focus on China, though, because we've been talking a lot in the last few days about the reopening in China versus, or I should say, lack thereof, as the nation continues to at least talk about tens of thousands of cases that it's seen, and report the first deaths over the weekend that we've seen in months in certain cities. What is your interpretation of what's happening in China? Is it investable right now?
China is a large market, probably not surprising to your sophisticated audience, but often surprising to investors to recognize that China has the largest equity market in the world by liquidity. Well known that China is a geopolitical powerhouse and economically really one of the superpowers today. Yes, absolutely. With COVID, the China growth story became a little bit more blemished, but we're starting to see the opportunity for China, even with just a few comments that came from President Xi earlier this month. The Chinese market is up more than 20% year to date, with a lot of volatility embedded within that, to your point on rising COVID numbers. I, perhaps like you, I'm very bullish that when China does reopen, it has the opportunity not only to allow the Chinese markets to bounce back even stronger, but to have downstream effects where the rest of Asia is likely to benefit from a China reopening theme, and the globe broadly, again, with inflation being where it is, to have China's supply chain back on, that can have a massive deflationary effect that the whole globe is hungry for.
Right.
But I do expect a bumpy ride, as we've seen in November.
I was going to say, many would argue that it will continue to be a bumpy ride, as it feels like sometimes policies coming out of China are one thing one day and another the following day. Asha, thank you so much. Asha Mehta, founder, chief investment officer of Global Delta Capital, her book, Power of Capital, An Adventure Capitalist Journey to a Sustainable Future.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio, or watch us live on YouTube and now also on Bloomberg Quick Take. Is realizing the full value of your network just a dream? Intel is bringing AI everywhere, building solutions to help modernize and monetize 5G infrastructure, making it possible for telecommunications providers to expand services and drive efficiency by reducing costs and saving energy. The next wave of networks starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, let's face it, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. There's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.